Welcome to another Wednesday night event at Warm Jewel Temple. It's such a familiar scene to sit in this room on a Wednesday evening. It's quite familiar for me to sit on this seat on a Wednesday evening. I don't know how many hundreds of times I sat on this seat and flapped my gums over the past 10 years, and looks like this is maybe the last time tonight. I think I'll do one more talk with Shoho together, and a kind of a question and answer ceremony, but the last time quite like this. It's always the last time just like this, and the first time. Something I've been thinking about for a little while, and wondered how to put it. I thought I'd try to explore this tonight. Over these 10 years, you know, I've talked with lots of you, and sometimes I feel like I get these like inklings that like maybe sometimes it seems to be kind of working, and sometimes it seems to not really work so well, you know, our meetings. And the thought that has been percolating for a while is, I think I sometimes neglect to acknowledge the fact that we have like different kinds of personalities. We have different dispositions, different karmic tendencies, different ways of viewing the world, different ways of living in the world, due to many causes and conditions, known and unknown, going way back to our childhood and probably long before. And because we have different dispositions and personalities, we maybe have different like sticking points that are like what hinder us from our wholeness, from our completeness, from our awakening, our liberation. Because we have different sticking points, our awakenings may be quite different. I think awakening in Buddhism is really, you know, awakening to our true nature, our wholeness and completeness. So our wholeness and completeness, I would propose, must be the same. But the sticking points which seem to block it, which seem to obscure it, those are different, I think, for different people. And, I mean, maybe, obviously. But I think I sometimes forget that. Because mainly what I know is my own sticking points and my own dispositions and personality. And so the things that worked for me and that were the experiences that have been most liberating for me are when, you know, kind of seeing through or dissolving particular sticking points. So for me, that's really exciting. And generally, I think what I talk about with others are the things that work for me. But sometimes I think, actually, other people might not have those same sticking points. They might have other ones. And sometimes you all tell me about them, and sometimes you don't. And even if you do, it's hard to know somebody else's experience and what's most helpful for them. So I say this partly as a kind of confession as I leave this place, that maybe a weakness that I've had as a teacher here is maybe just kind of unconsciously assuming that everybody sees the world the same way I do and has the same sticking points and will be liberated in the same way. It's kind of like, kind of a big shortcoming. But apparently I haven't been able to help it. Sometimes maybe you've taught me a lot, you know, about different ways of being in the world. So just to take one example, these days it's kind of dangerous to make any generalizations about gender. So I don't want to go there. But let's just say there's like masculine and feminine qualities of each person. Doesn't matter whether they're male or female. I think these are kind of like archetypal, it's like yin and yang kind of qualities. I think that's fair to say. Yeah, we can call them something like that. Does anyone know this teacher David Deida? Nobody knows David Deida. Well, I think he's really a spiritual teacher, but particularly focused on relationships. And so he likes to make this point that that there's these kind of qualities that everybody has, masculine and feminine qualities in their personality, and some are more dominant than others. And when intimate relationships really click, it's because of the kind of polarity of the masculine and feminine qualities that kind of like opposites attract, right? So the way he talks about, and it resonates with me, the we could say the feminine archetypal quality is like the wish to create and express and live fully in this world, manifest, like yearnings are the yearnings of everybody's feminine quality. And the masculine quality is kind of like the opposite of, like, it's like the wish to kind of disappear. It's the wish to not to manifest or create, but to like become one with emptiness. So there's teachings in Buddhism, luckily, about both these types of that address both these types of yearnings. There's teachings about great love and compassion, maybe, you know, very generally we could say associated with this feminine manifestation, creative, nurturing, loving impulse. And there's those teachings on emptiness and no-thingness and cessation for this masculine quality that yearns strongly to cease. That might sound strange, especially to those who are maybe more dominated by feminine quality. But I, speaking as someone, I think I have both these qualities, but I think my masculine quality it's really enlivened by Zen practice, which is why I love emptiness teachings. And I talk about them a lot. And and then sometimes I think, well, maybe actually some people, if they just get that side of things, it's not so nourishing or enlivening, or it doesn't even make sense. Like, what's the point of that kind of thing? But for the masculine quality, it's like, we love it. The masculine side loves this idea of like not being born. Oh, that's like the supreme dream of mine, is to never be born. Maybe sounds strange, And I think early Buddhism, foundational Buddhism, kind of emphasizes, I think it's has a really masculine flavor, like cessation and no more birth is like the supreme goal in early Buddhism. Mahayana, later Buddhism, starts to talk more about manifestation and emphasize compassion more as the supreme goal, and in impartial love for all beings. You don't hear that so much. It's there in the early teachings, but I think that's a shift to the Mahayana. And I, along with you, practice in the Mahayana. And I think maybe partly I'm drawn to it because maybe I feel like I need to balance this strong masculine tendency to want to not be born. And like kind of not do anything. It's kind of like maybe it goes with this non-doing is maybe a more kind of like a masculine urge, whereas doing and creating is a more feminine. So I think it's okay to talk like that without associating those with either gender. They're like qualities. So that's an example of two types of approaching practice and talking about practice. Whereas if you're really emphasizing one, maybe a lot of people either get just like, don't know what you're talking about, or just not interested. Sometimes there are talks about really working with emotions and all, and it's something I could work on too, but sometimes I get a little bit bored, or it's like, it's not my thing. I'm not as such an emotionally expressive person in general. We all have these different sides. So to expand on this beyond just these two ways, I thought it would be interesting to look at even more kind of personality types and how liberation and awakening might play out for all different types of dispositions or personality types in different ways. So this, it's kind of a big idea to try to do this with 9 personality types and 9 Zen stories of awakening that illustrate these different types of, 9 different types of awakenings. But let's see where it goes. These 9 types are the Enneagram. Does anyone know the Enneagram? Yeah. It's this, you know, it's a system of personality types. Some say it goes back to Sufis. I think no one really knows the origin exactly. But I think it's a beautiful system to talk about different types of human disposition. It opens my mind to realizing that everyone's not, doesn't see the world the same way as me. There's not even just one other way, there's 8 other ways. They say that each person has one particular disposition that they develop maybe in early childhood, and it always stays the same according to this system. But you can, that's your dominant type, and you can work within that to find a healthy balance of your unique personality type, and rather than getting too fixated on that type and unbalanced. And of course, so we all have all 9, but this system is proposing each person has one type throughout their life. And and particularly influenced by this book called The American Book of Living and Dying, which is a kind of a workbook for hospice workers, or people working with people dying in their last days, and how to relate to them and help them kind of find as much liberation, freedom as possible in their last days, dependent on their personality type. So kind of like learning how they work in the world, and then relating to them according to this personality type to help them release their sticking points. So it talks about these different types of liberation for these different personality types. So to just go through them in the traditional order of the Enneagram, these nine types. The first one is called the perfectionist or the reformer. And I propose that I fall into this first category of personality types. They have wings of different types, but this dominant type, long time ago when I first heard the system, I thought, I think that's the one. And when I keep taking the tests, which you can do, it keeps confirming that this is my type. I resonate with others also. So this perfectionist personality type tends to be idealistic, kind of rational, orderly, self-disciplined, a strong moral sense, ethical sensibility, which are, you know, those are the positive sides if they don't get too unbalanced or extreme. But if they get too unbalanced or too neglecting of other factors, then the perfectionist tends to be self-critical and angry, and especially angry if one's mission is interrupted, and that have the unbalanced feeling of like that nothing's ever perfect. I have to keep working on perfection and we'll never get there. So I think all these types, there's Zen practitioners of all these different types. This one, I can see how it's really, being this type has really like affected my way of practicing Buddha Dharma. There was a phase in my earlier years where I wanted to practice the 250 monastic precepts, which I diligently tried to follow for like 4 years. And like, it's kind of like a perfectionist thing. And I would read over them and like check off, you know, like, I want to be perfect person. That's kind of like my issue. Some of you be like, that is so bizarre. I'm totally not like that at all. So my kind of liberation, my sticking points and my liberation are going to be different than yours. So maybe my personality comes through in my talking about Dharma. Just like all the other teachers have their own unique types and their very different types of talks, I think, dependent on the personality. So so the liberation for a perfectionist could be put as a total acceptance of what is and the realization of the inherent perfection of everything, that everything is already perfect. So there's no more perfection to always feel like needs to be completed. And that rings true for me as a perfectionist. I think that's why I'm probably drawn to this Tibetan tradition called Dzogchen, which is translated as the great perfection. And that's what it's about. It's about the inherent perfection of Buddha nature. So the Buddha nature teachings, the emptiness teachings, the ultimate truth teachings of Buddha Dharma are all about inherent perfection. Which I think is partly why I'm really drawn to them. Whereas I feel a little like ashamed sometimes. That's a quality of perfectionists. That I could be emphasizing the compassion side a little bit more. But it's just not as juicy for me as perfection. This is like, I'm sort of exaggerating a little bit my approach to practice to make the point, but of course I'm interested in compassion, but you may have noticed, those of you who have been around for some years, lots of classes and talks on emptiness. We had a whole year on compassion, which is my idea to help myself. But I kept talking about it, I think, in these kind of analytical ways. And anyway, there are Zen teachings that have been liberating to me about inherent perfection. Like, I thought we could look at some of our ancestors here. ancestors in our lineage, the Chinese Zen ancestors. So the third Chinese ancestor, or the 30th ancestor since the time of Buddha, Sung San. Also, as you heard, that the perfectionist can be kind of like this concern with how they're doing and if, making sure that they're not doing anything wrong. Right? So that maybe the third ancestor was kind of a perfectionist because he came to his teacher and said, I have this disease and I beg you, teacher, to purify me of my wrongdoing. Purify my sins. I have this disease because I'm a sinner and wrongdoing, full of wrongdoing. Please somehow purify me. And the second ancestor said, well, bring me your wrongdoing and I'll purify you. And third ancestor paused a while and said, when I look for my wrongdoing, I can't find it. And his teacher said, I purified you of your wrongdoing. And that was his liberation, great liberation. And I love that story. He looked for his sin and wrongdoing to purify it and couldn't find it. Not finding something is called realizing emptiness. And that was his liberation. All this, these problems of mine, these faults of mine that I keep trying to work on and perfect, I finally see that they're not the real thing that I thought they were, that have to be fixed and can never be fixed if it's really real. And that was his liberation. And then later he wrote the Song of the Trusting Mind, where he said, the great way is perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing extra. To express this inherent perfection. So that's the first personality type. Second in the Enneagram system. Second one is called the helper or the caretaker. Quite different sounding, right, than the perfectionist. The helper, the positive quality, is they're always responding to others and have great compassion for others. Very naturally. It's like part of their personality. And they're kind of, when it gets unbalanced, the problems with the caretaker or helper is they start to ignore their own personal needs and their health declines and so on. And they also have deep pain when others hold a grudge against them. Like if, because they need to be helping. If somebody's like, you're not helping me, that's like the most painful thing for a helper. Right. And they need this approval. It's partly why they're driven to help. They're looking for approval from others, consciously or unconsciously. Again, this is my just like rough understanding of Enneagram, reading things about it. So if people know the system more, it's probably, you know, it's more complex, but the liberation for a helper with these qualities then could be to realize not the inherent perfection of the universe, but realize their inherent self-worth, that they don't depend on others' approval to be a worthy being in the world. That's their liberation. Even if I'm not helping others, and this is particularly important for the hospice workers to know when someone's dying, if they're a helper and they can't help anymore because they can't move. Then maybe that's the worst thing for a helper, so that their friend can try to skillfully bring out their own sense of self-worth. You don't need to help. You're okay. Even if you don't help, you're totally okay. That's their liberation, their awakening for a helper. Could be. And Oh, another way to put this is, so for the perfectionist, the liberation is, it's okay to get it wrong. For the helper, the liberation could be, it's okay not to help you back. I naturally want to help back. That's not a problem for the helper. But if I can't help you back, that's okay. That's the liberation for someone who's kind of maybe overly stuck in this this tendency. So a story about this could be our ancestor Yao Shan, Yakusan Igen. He hadn't come up to sit on the seat and give a Dharma talk for a long time. And somewhat like happened tonight, the temple director had to go find him. And said, everybody's waiting in the Zendo for your teaching. And they've been waiting a long time. Please, teacher, expound the Dharma for the assembly. So Yao Shan asked that person to ring the bell and that he's coming. And Yao Shan got up on the seat. And after a while, he just got right back down from the seat and went back to his room. And we know in this story that that Yao Shan, we know a little bit about his story before this happened, that in his youth, he was also kind of obsessed about these 250 precepts, about getting everything just right, like perfect monastic decorum. He was kind of obsessed about it, we hear. And he practiced that way for a long time, and at some point thought, Zen practice isn't just about like perfect decorum and getting all the precepts just right. There must be something more to it than that. So actually he wasn't practicing Zen, it was another Buddhist lineage. So he's like, I've heard the Zen people are into something that goes beyond just mere decorum. I'm gonna go find a Zen teacher. And he did and had some awakening. So maybe we can know that he was a, we could say a perfectionist, but maybe he was a helper in the sense that the precepts are about being really, really harmless to everybody around you. I really just want to not hurt anybody and I want to help everybody. Maybe he was that way. And he gave lots of talks, but I think he maybe cared about what people thought, but this time, later in his life, maybe he was really working on this point of, can I be free from what other people think about me? That's what the helper's sticking point is. So he didn't say anything. He's like, I know all these people want me to say something, but he just left without saying anything. If he was a helper type, maybe that was a kind of liberating moment for him of like, I can just go, and it's okay, actually. It's okay. It's okay to not help these people back in this situation in the way that they're expecting me to. And so he went back to his room, and the director followed him back to his room and said, a while ago you agreed to teach the Dharma for the assembly. Why didn't you say a single word? And Yao Shan said, for sutras, they're sutra teachers. For treatises, commentaries, there's commentary teachers. How can you question this old monk? That's Yao Shan's story. I'm sort of like, you know, imagining that they might be these different personality types. We don't know that much about these ancestors. The third type is the achiever, or the motivator. So these are, this personality type is devoted to the role or image of who they wish to be. They're devoted, diligent, and accomplished. These are some positive qualities. I might say it's a little like perfectionist, but I think perfectionist is more like, maybe they care less about what other people think. They have a really high standard for themselves. And achiever maybe is a little bit more like they're more into the role for others and achieving greatness in the eyes of others. And then their pitfall, the downfall, the sticking point, the obscuration to their wholeness is they may believe that they are nothing without their role, the achiever. So their liberation could be the willingness to fail and self-forgiveness. Maybe even just to be. As we heard that Suzuki Roshi once told one of his students, just to be alive is enough. So maybe for an achiever, that's a really liberating teaching. But for some other personality types, that is not a liberating teaching. In fact, this story from Suzuki Roshi was told by the Venerable Blanche Hartman. And she said she heard from her Dharma friend, Sojin Mel Weitzman, when they were practicing with Suzuki Roshi. I think this is how I remember the story, is that Mel said, you know, Suzuki Roshi gave me this great teaching. He said, just to be alive is enough. And Blanche was like kind of like jealous of that teaching. He always tells me to like practice harder. And I think she went to Suzuki Roshi and said, I think she told him, like, I heard that you gave this teaching, just to be alive is enough, to Mel. Why don't you ever say that to me? And he said, that teaching was for Mel. I have other teachings for you. Which may be exactly what we're talking about tonight, right? I don't know if Mel is an achiever. He doesn't seem, knowing him, he doesn't seem so much like the achiever type. But maybe at that time, in that situation, that was like the medicine Suzuki Roshi felt was the best for him. Just to be alive is enough. But somebody else is like, work harder. So liberation could be like, it's okay to not be successful for an achiever. So another one of our ancestors, Dungan Daopi. His teacher said to him, if you want to realize such a thing they're talking about, that which the Zen people want to realize, awakening. If you want to realize such a thing, you must be such a person. Kind of like, to realize this thing, you have to be an achiever, this kind of person, right? You must become, actually it says here, you must become such a person. If you want such a thing, you must become such a person. But then, he said, since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? And hearing that, Dungan Daopi was awakened. Maybe he was an achiever, and the preliminary to the story said he really did want such a thing and wanted to be such a person. And then he heard, he is such a person. Don't have to achieve anything else. The fourth type of personality type is the individualist or the dreamer. Oh, the romantic. I think it's sometimes called the hopeless romantic. And so this type is, all these types, by the way, there's no better or worse. So maybe we shouldn't say hopeless, but just extremely romantic. They're all have their fullness and completeness. It's a beautiful thing about this system. And they can all get unbalanced. So the romantic is creative, they're naturally intimate with others, they have a strong intuitive sense. Those are good things. But their sticking point is that they can become too identified with feelings and emotions, and lost in past and future thought about dreaming of like, that lover of mine was so sweet in the past, or like, I'm gonna have this lover in the future, something like this. And get pushed around too much by their emotions. So their liberation is like compassion for others and appreciation of the ordinary and the simple and just being present, not lost in the past and future. Not romanticizing about some future. So we could say, or the liberation is, it's okay to be ordinary and be seen as ordinary for a dreamer or romantic. So the next, and the 41st ancestor, Dung An Gwanjur, studied with this previous teacher, and he said, I've heard that the ancient Zen ancestors said, what worldly people love, I don't love. Some old Zen person said that. But teacher, I wonder what you love. I picked this story because he was into this love issue. I'm not sure about like not loving what worldly people love, like, because I love a lot of stuff. I'm a romantic. Do-an Kanshi could have been a dreamer or a romantic. But so we say, what do you love, teacher? These ancients say they don't love what worldly people love, but you must love something, teacher, because I love something. What are we going to do about this? And Do-an Daopi, Do-an Dohi said, I am already thus. And with these words, Do-an Kanshi was greatly awakened. What do you love, teacher? I'm concerned that I'm too much of a lover. What do you love, teacher? And he says, I'm already thus. It's kind of about ordinariness, and don't need to dream about any future. Don't need to be lost in romantic visions. So the fifth personality type is the observer, or the thinker, it's sometimes said. This type is focused and unattached. I've heard some Enneagram books often list a lot of historical people in each type, so you kind of get a sense for different personalities. And sometimes I thought it was interesting that they list Shakyamuni Buddha as this type number 5, the observer, like a kind of cool observer, just watching things from the side. I wouldn't really call the Buddha the observer. I would call Buddha like the one being that's like all 9 types equally. That's a special power of the Buddha, that he's not, can't fall into any category. So this type, it's nice to be focused and unattached as a Dharma practitioner, but their sticking point is they can be obsessed and overly analytical, kind of aloof, and they also have self-doubt, according to Enneagram. And therefore their liberation could be to open to humor and trust and self-forgiveness and to open to others and to find joy in struggle. And we could say, also put it that their liberation could be, it's okay to lose everything. It's just looking at these Enneagram commentaries, it might be harder to see how that's the case. So, the next ancestor, It just so happens to be that they're right in a row, all nine of them, huh? It's amazing. Nobody ever discovered this before. Actually, when I looked around back and forth, and it did just happen to fit nicely here. The 42nd ancestor was Liangshan. He studied with Douyin Kangxi, and Douyin Kangxi asked him, "What's the business beneath the patched robe?" What's the business beneath the patched robe? We have this patched robe that practitioners wear, like you have. What's the business? What's the matter? What's the thing beneath the patched robe? What's it really? This is just this on the surface. What's the great matter beneath the patched robe? And we could imagine that Liangshan was this cruel observer, so he was trying to check out, why is my teacher asking this? And what's the right answer to this question? And maybe like getting a little analytical about it. What's the business beneath the patched robe? What's the right answer here? But coolly and aloofly, listening to his teacher. And his teacher said, studying the Buddha way and not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. So if you, now you ask me. So the student asked, what is the business beneath the patched robe? And Dung'an said, intimacy. And Liangshan was greatly awakened. So maybe the liberation for the cool, aloof observer is to realize deep intimacy and no separation from others. The sixth personality type is the loyalist or guardian. They're like kind of loyal to a cause or a community. They're trying to make sure, they're like kind of a protector of people or institutions. And they have a need to make sense of things. Things have to make sense and be stable. And but their sticking point is that they can lack inner authority. And they're too black and white in thought. They're too either-or kind of thinking. And they get into worst-case scenario thinking. Maybe because they're kind of trying to protect things. That they're concerned about the danger of, what if things don't go well for my tribe that I'm so loyal to? And they think of all the worst case scenario in a way that kind of bogs them down. So their liberation could be freedom from external authority. They lack inner authority, and maybe the part of the loyalty is that it's kind of like we just trust the group mind. But they're missing their internal authority. So their liberation is trusting themselves with freedom from external authority. Their liberation might even be to break the rules. And their realization will be that all will be well and go okay. The summary in this one version is, the liberation is, it's okay to break the rules for loyalist. So, few ancestors later, Furong Daokai, the 45th ancestor in our lineage, asked his teacher, the words of the Buddhas and ancestors are like ordinary tea and rice, but is there anything else apart from these to help people? So he was concerned with like the words of the ancestors, and they seem so ordinary actually. All these Zen stories, they're not saying that much compared to like the sutras that give detailed explanations. These Zen stories are kind of short and sweet and sometimes don't seem to be saying much at all. But is there anything else that these ancestors help people with? Because I'm loyal to the ancestors and I want to know what they say. I would rely on what the ancestors say as a loyalist. So his teacher said, tell me, does the emperor's mandate in his kingdom depend on the ancient emperors, Yao, Shun, Yu, and Tang? In other words, does the present emperor's authority depend on all these great sage ancient emperors? They might be inspired by them, but actually, not really, right? They have their own self-authority. And Fu Rong was about to say something to answer the question when his teacher kind of struck him in the mouth with his fly whisk, which is like a Zen implement of authority, you could even say. He kind of like put the authority into his student's mouth and said, as soon as you started thinking, you immediately deserved 30 strikes with a stick. And when Fu Rong heard that, he was greatly awakened. And I understand that he was awakened from having to rely on the ancients. Because right after he was awakened in this story, he bowed and started to leave, and his teacher said, wait just a minute. And the student did not turn around, but just kept walking. And his teacher said, well, have you arrived at the realm of no more doubt? And the student just like covered his ears with his hands and kept walking. Now if he was like a loyalist who was relying on external authority and didn't trust himself, that was his liberation, right? It's a different type of liberation for these different people. It's what's striking me is that somebody else would hear the same thing and they'd be like, nah. I think different things will wake up different types. So the seventh type is the adventurer or the enthusiast. And this is a fun-loving, spontaneous, adaptable, idealistic, joyful, and compassionate type. Sounds nice. And they love adventure. My dad got really into this Enneagram system in the last few years. I think actually Shoho turned him on to the Enneagram. And so he's loves like putting all the family and all his friends into these different types, which you're not really supposed to do. You're supposed to just type yourself. But he swears that he's an adventurer at age 86. He just bought a new boat. But the pitfall of the adventurers is they tend to be scattered, distracted, somewhat superficial, fear of being trapped because they want freedom of adventure all the time. And and it's hard for them to take things seriously or to take people seriously. They're so carefree. So their liberation, interestingly, you might imagine what it could be. It's kind of like regular, disciplined practice, commitment, and opening to the suffering of others, more compassionate, and even solitude, these commentaries said. Kind of like they're so into like partying people, they should go off to a mountaintop or something to be liberated. So they're, interestingly, another way to put their liberation is it's okay to cry. Like they're so into always having a good time. The 47th ancestor in our lineage, Choro Serio, went to his teacher and said, what is the self, the true self, prior to the empty eon? Oh no, actually, excuse me, his teacher, Choro Serio's teacher, asked the student, what is the true self prior to the empty eon, like the primordial self, your true face before your parents were born. And Chorose started to speak in his adventuresome way, and his teacher said, "You're noisy," before he could even get a word out. "You're noisy. You should go away for a while." Which we could hear, like, "You're too exuberant and you want to just blurt it out and in this carefree way. Why don't you, you're kind of noisy, you adventurer." And then, so after he heard this, the student did climb up the mountain peak nearby and was awakened on the mountain peak. So the adventurer types maybe need to go into solitude and be less noisy. And he later said, when he appeared as a teacher, Chorose said, "When I was slapped by my former teacher, my cleverness disappeared, and when I tried to open my mouth, I couldn't. Is there anyone here who has not completely experienced such joy?" That's the adventurer's liberation. The eighth type is the asserter, or the boss, or the challenger. So, this type is decisive, confident, and self-reliant, but their downfall is that they can be confrontational and aggressive. So their liberation can be to give up control and to confess and repent. Or the short version is, their liberation is that it's okay to be weak for the boss type. So our ancestor Tendo Sogaku, was maybe a kind of bossy character, actually, because he was the attendant to his teacher, and one day the teacher said, "How do you see it these days? How do you see the matter these days? How do you view things?" And he said, "Suppose I say that I am thus." And his teacher said, "That's not enough. Say some more." And the student said, "Why isn't it enough?" Only a bossy student would talk back like that. And the teacher said, "Well, I actually don't say that it's not enough, but I think you're not quite familiar with that which is beyond." And the student said, "I can express that which is beyond." And the teacher said, "Well, what is that which is beyond?" And the student says, "Even supposing that I can express what's beyond, I can't put it into words for you, teacher." And the teacher says, "You really can't express it." And the student says, "Well, I ask you to say it, teacher." And the teacher says, "Ask me and I'll say it." So the student says, "What is that which is beyond?" And the teacher said, "Suppose I say that I am not thus." And at this, Tendo Sogaku was awakened, and the teacher gave his approval. When you have the bossy or the challenger students, the koan dialogues are longer. So the ninth type is the peacemaker, the reconciler. And they're easygoing, agreeable, non-confrontive, receptive. They live in the present and they're fine being nobody special. Sounds pretty good. They all sound pretty good in their own way. We might wish we were some other type than we are, but sorry. In this life. Their sticking point is that they can lose their self in others' agendas. They're just so into keeping the peace that they just go along with what other people say all the time, and they have a hard time finding their own opinion. And it's easy for them to sell out on what's important to them because they need to keep the peace. And they can also shut down because sometimes it's hard to do that, but they can't speak out or get angry because they're peacekeepers. And they can be apathetic when an issue calls for an opinion. So their liberation is to realize and assert their true self and realize their innate worth and commitment. And their liberation is, it's okay to disagree for a peacemaker. Right? That's kind of like the opposite of the liberation of the boss, who's always disagreeing. So I think it's really like skillful means for different people. And so just to finish a story, maybe a peacekeeper, one of our women ancestors. There's our ancestor whose name we chant. Shirji. And in this book of women ancestors, the stories, we don't have as many recorded stories of these women ancestors, so this compiler maybe added this in, saying, as long as her father could recall and her parents could recall, the only rule in life had been work and strife when Shirji was a young girl. Her father said, the people have four sorrows, reciting an old poem. The first is flood, the second drought, the third is locusts, and the last is warlords. You should know your place, he counseled the children. Keep your place and you might be safe. People are for raising grain and paying taxes, he used to say, so you better do these things well. So if he was really like that, and she was a good filial daughter, she was maybe a peacekeeper in the family and didn't, especially like women in old China, maybe almost had to be peacekeepers to get by in that kind of society. They can't speak out too much. But there were women who left home in the Buddhist tradition and became priests. And so she did this. And she walked for a long time in her nun's simple robes under a wide hat. She was looking for something worth seeing, worth taking off the hat to examine more closely, the compiler says. She was looking for something worth hearing and all the sounds of the world. All she saw was suffering. Everything seemed unsatisfied, changing and dying. So after years of practice, maybe in a very low-key, peacekeeper kind of way, she finally arrived at this hermitage of Judy, who lived there with a few other monks. And she didn't remove her wide bamboo hat when she entered the hall, as etiquette usually required. Instead, she walked around Judy's seat three times, saying, if you can say something, I'll remove my hat. Which I think in these days of like 7th century China, for a woman priest to kind of like bypass these rules of etiquette with a senior monk was pretty taboo. I think that's why the story is a little bit dramatic. So maybe as a peacekeeper, she's ready for her liberation. She's ready to assert her true being. She walked around him three times with her hat on and said, if you can say something, I'll take off my hat. If you can express yourself somehow. Because she is expressing herself as a peacekeeper. And Judy sat mutely, transfixed by a sight he had never seen before. She repeated herself, circumambulating him as though he were a stupa, three times, and then once again, and he had no answer. Anything, she asked? Anything worth saying? Silence. Shirji marched through the hall past him, bowed before the dusty iron Buddha, and marched out without another word. Judy suddenly snapped to her senses and said, wait a minute, it's late, you should stay for the night. And she said, well, can you say something? If you can say something, I'll stay. And he couldn't think of anything to say, so she left. And the other monks laughed at him, but they didn't suggest anything either that he could have said. And Judy thought, I have the form, but I don't seem to have the spirit. A person of the Dharma should be able to speak just like that. I'll leave tomorrow and see what I can find. Later, he did meet a teacher whose only teaching was to just hold up one finger. And Judy realized awakening with this teacher. But depending on our personality, somebody could hold up a finger, you know, 1,000 times, and we would just be like, huh? What kind of weird Zen thing is that? It's like no help for me. But Judy, was his personality, his disposition was ripe for awakening in that way. Well, it's the last time that I'm going to speak over time in this hall. So thanks for your patient presence for putting up with so much gum flapping from a perfectionist who's kind of like obsessed with some weird stuff that only 1 out of 9 of you can deal with. So I deeply apologize. I vow to learn more about all personality types and try to meet you all in whatever way I can for the benefit of all beings. I would dedicate the merit of this exploring the Dharma of the Enneagram and our lineage ancestors to the complete awakening of all 9 personality types throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.